Harry Holzer is an economist and a professor of public policy at Georgetown University. He's written widely on issues relating to low-wage labor markets, and in particular, the problems of minority workers in urban areas. Prior to coming to Georgetown, Professor Holzer served as the chief economist at the United States Department of Labor. He's also the author of many books, the most recent of which came out in 2011, titled Where Are All the Good Jobs Going? The book is written with co-authors Julia Lane, David Rosenblum, and Frederick Anderson. He joins us today by Skype from his office at Georgetown. Professor Holzer, welcome and thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Andy. It's good to be here.
I want to start out by reading a quote from your book. You write, "Overall, the findings suggest that besides our need for more jobs overall in the aftermath of the Great Recession, job quality matters importantly for long-term trends over time in worker inequality and insecurity in the United States." Give us a few more details about the key takeaways from your book.
Well, what I did in the book is I had a data set that enables us to separate out the quality of jobs from the quality of workers. There's been a lot of analysis in labor economics that says actually separate from the skills of the worker, the same worker can be employed in high-wage jobs or low-wage jobs, and that matters a lot. What kind of job do they actually get? And there's been critics, both on the left and the right, that have argued that good jobs are disappearing from America, whether they blame it on immigration or on globalization or anti-union forces, they seem to agree that good jobs are disappearing from America. So that was the first thing I tried to analyze in the book. When you look over time at a long period, does that turn out to be true? What I found is, in fact, that's not the case. High-paying jobs for workers of a given skill level are not necessarily disappearing in America. That's the good news. But in fact, where we find those jobs is changing, and for whom those jobs exist is also changing. I'm finding many fewer of those good-paying jobs in manufacturing than we said, say, a generation ago. More of them are in other industries, whether it's professional services, healthcare, construction, even in some cases in the higher end of retail. So the location of the good paying jobs is changing. And in general, fewer of those good jobs are available for workers that bring really low levels of education and skill to the labor market. So a generation ago, a prototypical good job might have been a factory job in manufacturing on an assembly line. You could be a high school graduate or even a high school dropout and still get a good job that pays good wages. Today, a prototypical good job might be in health technology or in IT services or maybe in construction, certainly before the recession. And those jobs require a higher level of skills going in before the employer is willing to invest in that employee and hire them and then pay them a higher wage on the job. So good jobs still exist. They're not disappearing. They're still growing in magnitude, but in fact, they require a higher level of education and training of different kinds than did the good jobs of a previous generation.
So you note in the book that some of the policy implications of those findings touch upon subjects such as improving the education and skills of Americans so that more people can fill the kinds of good jobs that are becoming available. You also mentioned directly creating more good jobs for low-skilled workers and also expanding the set of earnings supports and other supports for unemployed folks and low earners. Expand on that, if you would. If you were talking to staff of a mayor's office or a governor's office or somebody in an agency focused on economic development or workforce development, how would you articulate the policy implications of the findings from the book?
Well, I think, you know, the argument, it's a mixed argument. It says on the one hand, good jobs still appear. And in some cases, employers seem to have some difficulty filling those good jobs. And you do see this, for instance, of the jobs remaining in manufacturing, a lot more of them are of the nature like machinist type jobs or other kinds of technician jobs or engineering jobs, which if they don't require a four-year bachelor's degree, they certainly require a higher level of math competency and a higher level of certification than they used to. So those jobs still exist. In some cases, what we need to do is to improve the preparation of workers for good jobs that are still being created in the industries where they're still being created. And that means having an education system, high schools and community colleges, and four-year colleges, technical colleges, that are more in tune with the labor market and that are better at meeting labor market needs and demands for skilled workers. On the other hand, it also implies that if we have economic development efforts, we want to try to make it easier for employers to create good jobs. And if employers, so there's employers who might be on the margin of opening a factory here in America versus overseas, and we want to make it easier for them to open that factory here in the U.S. Well, we want to make sure we want to provide technical assistance for good employers, maybe some tax credits and subsidies, but also make sure that those employers can, in fact, find the skilled workers that they need to fill those jobs. And I've heard discussions by CEOs recently who are right on that margin of trying to decide whether their next plant should be in the U.S. or overseas. And when they find it easier to find skilled labor, they're more likely to open that plan in America or to upgrade the quality of the skills they're looking for. So what it means is it's a set of policies, some of which directly target the education and training side of the labor market, making them more responsive, and some of which actually work hand in hand with employers to make it easier for them to open facilities that require a higher set of skills, or maybe make it easier for them to upgrade the skills that they have. In the nursing home industry, for instance, a lot of employers are frustrated with the high level of turnover they face. Well, in some cases, it's possible to work with those employers and have them upgrade the quality of the jobs they provide, if in fact those employers also will feel like it'll be easy for them to find the skilled workers they need to fill those jobs. So it's paying attention to both sides of the labor market, both to the skills of the workers, the institutions that provide those skills, as well as the economic development efforts that reach out to employers, making sure all of them in sync, encouraging employers, helping them, and making it easier for them to find the skilled workers that they need to fill those good jobs.
Are there any examples that you would recommend that we look at in terms of solid relationships between the public sector and businesses in terms of helping them with their workers in that way?
You know, one of the best examples I know is, in fact, in your own state, the Wisconsin Regional Training Partnership. In some ways, it follows that model. They train workers, but they pay a lot of attention to the demand side of the labor market, and they work hand in hand with employers. So it's not like you're giving workers a general set of skills and then sending them out to find good jobs on their own. You're targeting the training towards jobs that currently exist and working with employers to make sure the skills fit what they're looking for. The intermediaries that have the confidence of employers are the ones that develop a reputation for delivering high quality workers, and the employers are more willing to trust those intermediaries when they have that kind of track record. And I think the Wisconsin Regional Training Partnership, which has been rigorously evaluated and does seem to provide training for disadvantaged workers that really does seem to boost their earnings quite significantly. That's a nice example that pulls those pieces together. The CALS operation in Wisconsin, the Center on Worker Skills, I believe it's called, is a similar example, I think, that works with employers, helps them to upgrade the quality of the jobs, but then makes sure that workers have the skills to meet those jobs. There are a variety of states, including Wisconsin, but also others, Pennsylvania, Michigan, state of Washington, that to various degrees developed sectoral strategies at the state level, where they would target certain sectors that were already creating good jobs and trying to make it easier, trying to align their education and training systems with where the demand was occurring, whether it was in healthcare or IT or other kinds of technology. But again, a state that then brings in its economic development strategies to then encourage and insist employers to create more of those kinds of jobs, then adds another dimension. It's not just about education and workforce. It could be about economic development, too. And where all those pieces fit together, the state is likely to be successful, I think, at generating good jobs and good workers to fill them.
Okay. By the way, for our viewers, I will post links to the Wisconsin Regional Training Partnership as well as the Center on Wisconsin Strategy to our website. Professor Holster, I want to end with one final question, which is, we know that governors and mayors and county executives across the nation are trying to find ways to spur job growth, especially coming out of a deep recession. Are there any strategies that you would be cautious about, or that you would say they should potentially avoid as they go about trying to spur job growth in their jurisdictions?
Well, you know, I think a couple of things. First of all, if we go down the sectoral pathway, sometimes there can be a trade-off. Employers, like anyone else, are looking for a free ride if they can find them. And employers should still have some skin in the game. They're going to benefit from the skills of these workers. Seems reasonable that they should at least provide some of the resources for training. You don't want it to be a complete free ride. And you don't want to set up a system that really works to the detriment of the disadvantaged. In general, what employers would love to find is middle-class, middle-skilled workers that they don't have to train themselves, who don't bring any difficulties of their own. And a purely demand-driven model might leave out workers with certain disadvantages. So you don't want to go that way. You don't want to make it so demand-driven and so driven on employer needs that the needs of workers with some skill deficits aren't paid attention to. So I think that's one pitfall. Of course, another pitfall is that when we train these workers, you know, you got to make sure that there is some demand in the labor market. In a very soft labor market, you might worry that you train workers and they go through all this training and they come out at the end and the jobs aren't there. I think in general, it's still better to be a trained worker and to have a post-secondary credential than not to have one. But you do want to pay some attention to what's going on the demand side and not overtrain in a soft economy. I'd say the last pitfall to be careful of is you don't want to train too narrowly, because we know that, you know, labor markets are dynamic. The skill sets that employers are looking for shift over time in response to new technologies and global forces. You don't want to train your workers so narrowly that the jobs may exist today, but that tomorrow they might be out of a job. So you want a couple things. I think you want to make sure all these workers are getting sort of a broad skill set, so that if demand shifts a little bit, they can still be in contention, maybe with a little bit of retooling. You know, there was a lot in the last year or two written about shortages of welders, which is surprising, because given the nature of the construction industry and manufacturing, there are a lot of unemployed welders. And a lot of employers were saying, well, I know I can find a lot of welders, but I'm looking for this kind of welding. Well, you want a kind of education and training system where that if a particular employer needs a slightly different kind of welder or a slightly different kind of software engineer, they can plug into that system and do a little bit of retooling. See, what you want is a flexible system, not too rigid, responsive to the needs of employers, but still at the same time where workers get a good general base and where it's not too difficult for employers to upgrade their current applicants or their current employees if what they're looking for is a little different. And I think it's possible to create those kinds of systems, but they do require some nimbleness, make it easier for employers to invest a little bit sometimes in retooling if they can't find exactly what they're looking for on the outside market.
The book is titled Where Are All the Good Jobs Going? And I want to thank Harry Holster for being with us today and for sharing his insights, and also for really an impressive body of research that's helping practitioners and policymakers to assist American workers. Thanks, Professor Holster.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure. Thank you.